On this episode, I spoke with sterilization expert Gene Moldenhauer. You may remember Gene a few episodes ago. We discussed autoclaving. In this episode, we focus on irradiation sterilization. Gene talks through the different methods of irradiation like gamma, X-ray, and E-beam. She talks through the different pros and cons as well as environmental impacts. Gene delves into the practical considerations associated with irradiation, things like product density, cycle development, dosimeters, sterilization, and bioburden. She also talks through the regulatory process. I hope you enjoy this episode with Gene, and I'm looking forward to having her on again to talk through other sterilization methods.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sadeh. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery, so this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
So first and foremost, irradiation is different than autoclaving in that there's different modalities, right?
Well, yes and no. Autoclaving has subsets as well. Radiation, the subsets are a little more different from one to another. If you're using an autoclave, you either use saturated steam or almost dry heat. Whereas in radiation, you have things like gamma, beta, microwave, X-ray.
Could you go through the main modes of irradiation that you see? I agree with you. I think what I was trying to get at is, and maybe that's a good point of clarification, that maybe the perception is that gamma and E-beam and X-ray are much more different than autoclaving, but the reality, it's just a spectrum, isn't it? So yeah, that's actually a really helpful clarification.
To be honest, when we think about all the different ways to sterilize, we think of five main ways: waste heat, dry heat, radiation, aseptic gas. Filling, and gas. I was missing one there for a minute.
Yeah, gas.
And those are kind of the main categories, and then there's slight variations in each of them. So, for example, we talked about which ones were different in radiation. And gas, you may have ethylene oxide, you have chlorine dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, ozone. So again, they all have different subsets, but it all ties back to basically five methods of sterilization.
The most common is gamma in irradiation?
In irradiation, it's gamma, although there's an increasing use of what they call E-beam or beta.
Oh. Is there any environmental, is gamma anything like what's going on with ETO?
It has aspects that are more like ETO, and it has aspects that are more like steam, both.
I mean, from an environment, like, is there any environmental concern with cobalt in the same way that people are worried about ETO, and you know, there's a whole effort to reduce the number of and stuff like that?
I think the biggest concern is what to do with waste, because if you have irradiated waste, you know, there are some things with disposal and things like that, but nowhere near the concern that you have for gas sterilization and cancer producing situations from the ethylene oxide.
Uh-huh. Okay. So what distinguishes the gamma, E-beam, X-ray, microwave, is it the source of the radiation?
The source, and then there's slight differences in how effective they are for different things. You know, you think of an X-ray, you have X-rays you get an x-ray, and theoretically after the x-ray, you're safe and nothing happened to you from the x-ray. But even x-rays can do cellular damage on a long-term basis or at a high dose. And so you have to understand what the consequences are of the dose on your products and how well it penetrates and things like that. So if you're talking about E-beam, when one looks at cycles for E-beam, one of the things you have to look at is whether the product density is such that the E-beam will get through. Does it take multiple passes? E-beam's a little different. You know, you put something in, you irradiate, and you're done. With E-beam, you may have to run it through the cycle multiple times because it's on a conveyor belt, and they want to do both sides of the package and this and that because it's more density related.
So what are the factors that go into a cycle? Obviously, there's a mode that you're using, but you mentioned product density. You mentioned the number of passes. Exposure time?
The big thing in general on radiation is how much dose, how you get the dose, whether you get it in one fell swoop of, hey, I zapped it with a high level of radiation all at one time. But more commonly, it has some sort of conveyor belt or system for routing it through exposure to the radiation until you've accrued enough radiation to get the kill level you want.
Are all of the different modes typically set up in the same way? Would you be able to, for example, interchange, how do I phrase this question?
Could I have one plant that does the same, one sterilization room or something that does different types? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Can
Typically
I just
not.
I can't just take the gamma heart out of it, put a E-beam heart, and it just runs the same?
Usually not, because
so long as just
the requirements for shielding and how it's exposed and things like that are different. So I think I talked a little bit about E-beam. A lot of the commercial sites that do E-beam sterilization, it's a long conveyor belt that the boxes go through, and some of them turn the boxes around so that in one pass you get the E-beam on one side of the box, on another pass on this conveyor belt, you get it on the opposite side, so it's turning them and things like that to get different exposures to the container. And others are more like a batch sterilizer kind of concept where you have it all together and it stays the same, but the radiation is slightly different. And it's usable if you're going to use radiation to look at the websites from the vendors you use, because they typically give you a lot of tips about how their cycle runs, whether it turns packages around, whether the cycles are long or short. And so they do provide, in general, a large amount of information you can use. Understanding.
In what situations would you consider gamma the most preferable? Is it where it's no drug product, and it's only like a device or component?
Oddly enough, gamma's getting used for more things than before, because gamma has the ability to sterilize your device, for example, the combo product, and in some cases, the drug. One of the big uses for it, for example, is if I want to terminally sterilize a lyophilized drug. There's some work done by Dr. Yaman where he showed that they could take their lyophilized drugs and sterilize them, terminally sterilize them using gamma radiation.
With no impact to the drug's potency.
Well, everything has an impact, so you've got to adjust the dose to compensate for the impact. But in general, they were able to do it without forming a lot of free radicals that would be dangerous to people. That's probably the biggest impact on the drug is, or the container, is the ability to form free radicals from irradiation. And some of those are hazardous to the people using the product.
In terms of the materials that you can use gamma with, is it plastic and glass are acceptable, rubber is acceptable, or are some of them like point blank, no way?
it's really tied to how much degradation the container closure system or the material gets. And so one of the early development studies you do is looking at what happens when I have such and such a dose of radiation. Is the material still fit for use? Does it function properly? Is it distorted, defigured, things like that?
And that's where you, for example, would hit it with like 40 kgy or 50 or something like that.
Usually.
And so it's you wouldn't say it's like don't use glass or don't use rubber or don't use, you wouldn't make any kind of wide sweeping conclusion.
You'd have to evaluate it for your product and container. There's some literature, and again, the vendor websites will say, hey, this one doesn't work as well with this process.
Yeah. But
it's generally considered a wide range replacement for the gas sterilizations that you used to use for medical devices. Only in more recent years, in the last 15, 20 years, have we started looking at it on drugs. And again, quite often it's either the API or something like a lyophilized drug.
What about discoloration with gamma?
Always a problem that you, again, it gets back to that material evaluation. What can you live with? What can you cannot? You know, if you view filtration cups, we know that irradiation can discolor some of the plastics that we use with it. So can autoclaving, believe it or not. If it's something that's reusable, you can say, hey, it's reusable, but probably around 50 or 100 times of autoclaving, it's going to discolor, fracture, or things like that. So they all have some issues. You just have to understand them and see if they're applicable within your process.
In terms of validation or developing the cycle dose, I know it's called cycle development for autoclaving. Is it the same for?
Yes.
Okay. So in the process of going through cycle development, is it the same process regardless of what modality it is? Modality, the right word? Like,
yeah, I mean, to be honest, 99% of what we do, people use either gamma or E-beam.
Okay.
We don't tend to use as much X-ray or microwave, although they've been looking at some of those with some of the biotech and combo products because there's some advantages to some of them with cell degradation and things like that that they can have an effect on.
Okay. We'll get to that last bit. The 99% being gamma and E-beam, what percentage is gamma in your experience and what percent is E-beam? Is it like 50-50?
Historically, up until the last couple of years, it was 99 to 100% gamma. There weren't as many E-beam facilities that you could go to for contract manufacturing. I think that's one of the biggest differences with irradiation sterilization is very few people have their own irradiators. E-beam makes it a little easier for them to have an irradiator because the way E-beam works, you can have about a cubic meter size E-beam sterilizer that's in line with all the shielding and everything. It sounds small, but by the time you put all the other things around it, not so small. But the way the dose works, you shoot it through. So you would go through, like, for example, manufacturing line with vials, and a single vial at a time would go through the E-beam sterilizer. And so it happens quickly, it happens fast, you can do it in line. And so it has some attractive features about it. So there's more people looking at it now. There are more commercial places that offer E-beam in addition to gamma radiation. Typically, it's the same kind of vendors that you had for gamma. There's a few that specifically have dedicated plants to doing E-beam.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the factors that you would consider when going about developing a gamma cycle, you mentioned that kind of one of the first things that you do is you see you almost do a study
where you expose it beyond what you would ever see to sterilize it and see what happens to it in terms of function, discoloration, degradation, all of that. Have you ever seen a situation where something didn't reveal itself during that first evaluation that did reveal itself later on?
One of the, again, when it makes free radicals, you wouldn't necessarily see them immediately. They could show up during stability, or they could show up as product degradation over time. So they more likely show up in things like stability.
When you say free radicals, what do you mean?
It does a chemical reaction and it makes something new. So I started out with such and such plastic, and now it has other impurities in it, for lack of a better word, that are these chemical structures that are called free radicals. And they have the ability to quickly attach, detach, break apart cycles and that. Cycles to break apart molecules is what I meant. And so they, because they're radicals, they typically have either free roaming electrons or protons that can bind with other things and cause bad things.
How are they, like, how would you discover that you have free rad? I'm just trying to see, because, you know, it sounds like would it come up on an assay?
Sometimes they could come up on assays that you did on the material. Sometimes you may find them, unfortunately, in a clinical trial, which is a bad time to find them.
Yeah.
It gets back to looking at really analyzing your material after you do your evaluation. Does the sterilization cycle have an issue with the material? You know, sometimes you can see them because it discolors or something like that, or you start getting impurities you didn't have before, I think is probably the most common way to realize you have a problem.
Elemental impurities?
Could be peaks on your spectra.
Okay. So it's an HPLC for the most part is where you would see it, unless it's something gross like visible discoloration. I think what I'm trying to ask, in other words, is let's say you're down the line and getting ready to validate a cycle. And Eugene, with all your experience, comes in and says, hey, did you check for free radicals? How would I demonstrate that?
One of the things I would look up before I decided I was going to do gamma sterilization, I'd look to see if there's any literature for that material about sterilization. The good news is most academics are very good about publishing their literature and putting them in nice free databases like Academia or things like that, where you can find the article. Some of them still publish their data. You just have to pay to get the article. But that's probably a useful tool. And to be honest, that's true for any type of sterilization. Is it sensitive to heat? Is it sensitive to humidity? Is it sensitive to gamma? And so you can find some literature for most of them.
How much impact does how the material was processed previously play into the gamma process? So for example, let's say you have a, and I know a lot of OEMs that manufacture material resins, let's say for injection molding, they'll have gamma grade versus whatever grade versus, they kind of grade them like that in some cases. Let's say you have a gamma grade material that was extruded versus injection molded. Would you look at them any different, or?
Not unless I found something in the literature that told me there was an issue.
Okay. So the literature review plays a big role, it sounds
for
like.
For me.
Because
not everybody does it that way, but that's one of the things I look at, because you learn a lot by other people's mistakes. I'd prefer not making them myself.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get at is the rules of, we'll say, mistake avoidance. Because I do agree, why test something? I've seen situations before where we should have never selected a material, and that could have been
avoided by just doing a paper exercise or a Google search.
That and you know, the other...
And we found out later, I should say. We found out later than we could have.
Yes, it's frequently cheaper to do it right the first time. But I just find them to be very useful and learn from what other people found, because a lot of times in some of these academic papers, you'll find they may not have found what the real problem was, but you may pick it up in reading their paper that, hey, did you look at this or that? You know, and it gives you a better idea how to look at your material study. What other things do I want to look at in my material? So I find it useful to do a little bit of research to go with it.
And again, at this point, you wouldn't approach this any differently if it were E-beam or gamma.
Not particularly.
Yeah.
And unless there was, again, something in the literature that specifically told me, hey, this is a problem. Now, if I have something that's very dense, for example, I'm just going to pick one of these. You know, like a lot of blood banking bags, there may be 15 bags attached to each other that are all going to go inside one package that could be very dense. And it would be hard to sterilize by E-beam if it's very dense, if it doesn't have the penetrating ability that gamma does.
Is bioburden just as important of a consideration for irradiation as it is for autoclaving? Or is it more, in my experience, there's been more of an emphasis on understanding the bioload for irradiation, maybe more so than autoclaving?
Let me start one step earlier in that process. When we talk about steam sterilization or things like that, and we talk about an overkill, I'm not as worried about bioburden. If I do a product specific cycle, I am more worried about bioburden. In irradiation, it's kind of the same thing, in that the lower the dose that I'm giving you of irradiation, the more I'm concerned about whether there's organisms out there that are going to be resistant to the radiation. And there are some specific microorganisms that if you happen to have them in your plant, you'd want to know, because they're radiation resistant microorganisms. They're not real common, but every now and then you can find them in your plant. And so you'd like to know some things about what kind of organisms would be resistant to radiation, and are those organisms you have in your facility. Very often they start out with some kind of name that says radio something, to give you a big hint that it's a radiation-resistant organism. That's a concern, but the bigger issue with radiation is the dose. How much radiation did I give them? And it doesn't have to be all at one time. I could do it in sequences if I wanted to get the amount of radiation dose there. And that dose, if I'm up to such and such a dose, I know I have that much kill in my batch, which is why we look at the levels of bioburden, the types of bioburden, and things like that in the cycle.
For, because there are different levels that would be, there are different doses that would be acceptable as a as an effective sterilization cycle that's based on the bioburden.
So yes,
I've seen some number, maybe it was 100 CFU per something or other.
Yeah.
That was the kind of minimum that, or the maximum that would be allowed. Otherwise, you'd have to do something more. Maybe it was 20 kilograms. I don't remember. I don't know.
There are different levels, and there are charts that tell me if I have this much and I have this many products and whatever. It's kind of like matching up a matrix and say, oh, there's just the point I want to be at. And the higher the radiation dose is, in general, it's like lower how much other data I need. Kind of, again, that overkill concept. If it's product specific, if I'm going to a much lower dose of radiation, I probably need no more environmental data to support that that will kill what's in my environment. But we have a sterilization dose that we would routinely use. You have something called the verification dose, and that dose would tell me how much cycle I need to get a one log reduction in the biological population. So if I need a 6 log reduction or a 12 log reduction, I know I'm going to have that verification dose times however many logs of kill I need. And so you need to know how many logs of bacteria you have in your facility to know how many you have to kill to get to that magic 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the, I'm sorry, 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 3 sterilization likelihood of a non-killed organism.
The 10 to the minus 6 versus 10 to the minus 3 distinction, that's sterile versus decontaminated?
In the olden days, when I was a newbie in sterilization, it was believed to be acceptable to be 10 to the minus 3 for a lot of medical devices.
Really?
And so that's kind of still changing because as our technologies have improved, so have their requirements tightened. But in the old days, there used to be a lot of devices that we said 10 to the minus 3 was good enough.
But that's not the case anymore.
There are still countries and regulations that allow for 10 to the minus 3, but there's more details about them. Is this something that's inside, that goes inside the body? Does it say outside the body? What's it used for? Does it have to have that higher level of sterility assurance?
Interesting. What dose mapping? So you talked about the
dose being important. Density.
The dose is important, but like, how can you, is it the less packed it? Okay. So let's say I have a box. I can fit theoretical maximum that I can fit into the box is 1,000. If I put in 100 and they're all spaced out, that's easier to sterilize than being all together 10x the density.
Could be. And that's one of the things we try to resolve in doing things. You know how in a steam sterilization cycle, you would put BIs in different places to load? Mm-hmm. We use little dosimeters.
Yeah.
Different places in the load. And it does the same thing that the BI did. It told you whether you got biological kill. The dosimeter tells you whether you're getting biological kill, not by having biological indicators in it, but by what dose is there. So then I know that if I get to the specified dose, I know how much log reduction I have.
So I think biological indicators are a little bit clearer, at least for me in my head. It's an organism, and is it still alive after the cycle is the measure, right?
Correct.
How do dosimeters work?
The dosimeter just tells me how much radiation I was exposed to, and again, I was talking about the verification dose. We know from that verification dose that if it's this number, I killed one log of microorganisms. So I can do the calculations accordingly. How much is the total dose I have to get the right number of log reductions I need?
In terms of kind of the proof being in the pudding, is it typically the same in that there's also a sterility test that's done as well?
There is at least in validation. Again, it depends on the specific cycle. There are people that use parametric release for radiation as well, with just the dosimeter readings. And they've correlated that at some time during their development process with the sterility testing.
So that was something I was going to ask about. It's called dosimetric release. The dosimetric release is based on the dose received, because dosimeters are in every cycle.
Yes.
And they put them in places in the worst case, what they perceive to be the worst case. They have to justify where they put them.
They have to justify where they put them. Most of the people that do irradiation as a contract service, they have way more knowledge than we do on where the right places are to put them because of how many different load sizes that they do. And so you would verify that in some of your development cycles, that the dosimeter placement makes sense and that you're getting good kill throughout your load.
But for dosimetric release, you would look at the dosimeter. Did it receive the appropriate level of
radiation?
Irradiation exposure, and from there you'd say release.
Generally, yes.
Okay. Is there any justification that needs to be put for, I remember in the last discussion that we had, you were talking about the history behind parametric release, and I think the company was Baxter, you said, that kind of put parametric release into industry, and they had to work hard, at least at the outset, to justify it.
Yes.
What is the history on dosimetric release? Is it a little bit more of an open shut case?
Devices used to use, most devices were gas sterilized in the olden days. Mm-hmm. And they used to use little dots that told you whether or not they were exposed to the ETO and things like that. So they always were a little bit more open to a parametric type of release because of the gas sterilization. And then the dosimeter became the replacement for the BI or the thermochemical indicator that told you that it was exposed to sterilization. So it was a little easier adjustment than when we went to steam.
Uh-huh. Okay. Makes sense. A combination products comment that you made earlier. You were talking about the use of irradiation for filled product. What does the horizon look like for drug product and using irradiation?
Again, with the E-beam, you don't need... Let me re-say that. With E-beam, they have these ability to put the small lines in place at facilities. So they have the ability today to run vials through, and it's the cycle is so short, it's the same amount of time as your conveyor belts are running. So it's like one more step through one more tunnel or something like that, and you can sterilize it too. And so it's become more prevalent to evaluate it. The downside is it's an expense. You want to evaluate it before you buy one for your site, because unlike the $250,000 for other kinds of sterilizers, you're probably talking at least $1 million for an E-beam sterilizer. The good news is it's very quick. You can do it in a production line on a conveyor belt. And so appealing, but a lot of people, anything new, the pharmaceutical industry will be 25 years behind anybody else.
I suppose when I heard you say vials the first time, I heard empty vials.
You're oh, they could be filled. Vials.
Okay. And so that's E-beam?
Yes.
What about things like syringes, pens, so on? You're saying that you would typically would do the container by itself. You wouldn't do it assembled.
When people do the container by itself, usually that's because they're going to aseptically fill the container.
You would do the filled container by itself. In other words, the question that I have is, let's say you had a aseptically filled cartridge that was not terminally sterilized yet, and you had assembled components like a pen assembly around that cartridge or around that pre-filled syringe without a plunger rod. Could you assemble it all together and then gamma? Because it would theoretically sterilize all the internal surfaces as well as the inside of the drug-filled container.
There are more people looking at doing that because of the push for terminal sterilization. So something, the one I think of as a good example of that is something like an auto injector, where the drug is there. You've got a special container to let the patient give their administration themselves. And if you can meet all the density requirements in that, some may look at E-beam, some may look at gamma.
Have you seen that on a finished combination product like that?
Have I seen it? Yes, I've seen people that did development for it.
Okay.
Whether I don't always know whether they, if they had problems in getting it approved, sure. Unless they came back to me.
But theoretically speaking, I guess if
yes, it's possible.
It's possible. Because there's obviously a big convenience factor there. If you can get it to its finish and then just sterilize it, it reduces a lot of the figuring out of the issues that could happen in the changing of the hands of each component, each subassembly, the filling.
And not having to have multiple sterilization cycles, because stop and think, if you pre-sterilize the componentry, you're talking about the plunger or the plunger stopper, the syringe barrel, needles, whatever. You could be looking at several different sterilization cycles and then throw all that good sterilization data away because you're going to aseptically fill it and can't contaminate it. So,
do you think that's where the industry is going to get to, where they can sterilize finished product?
I'd like to see it go that way because I'm a strong proponent of terminal sterilization. Like I said, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole is very resistant to change and slow to accept new technology.
Between, autoclaving a finished combination product like a syringe or a filled pen has its obvious. It's not super common. There are some cases where it's done, but in my experience, a lot of times you would just aseptically fill, or like in the biologic space in particular, focusing on other kinds of products, like let's say biologics. Is there one irradiation that works better for those kinds of products? Or
it's really more dependent on the product and what you can withstand for the product. For example, you may need a higher dose if you use cobalt than E-beam, because the same thing with the product density and all those kinds of things. But if you can make it work, it's ideal because you're doing it all at one time. With moist heat, you run into some problems in that you have to get that level of heat to all areas of the product. That doesn't seem to be the same issue with irradiation. You still have to sterilize all the sections, but it doesn't seem to be as difficult to get a 6-log reduction in the syringe and the product.
Interesting. It sounded like from there, is E-beam quote unquote stronger?
I don't know that it's stronger. It has to do with you're sterilizing a much smaller amount at a time. If I'm doing a single syringe or a single vial, it's a whole lot easier to get the killing dose without having to accommodate 300,000 vials in the sterilizer.
Sure. In terms of validation for irradiation, is it typically an open shut, very checklisty approach? And most of the evaluation is where you would narrow down maybe some of the engineering of it? Or would you expect to see completely different approaches to validation depending on the product?
Because we tend to use contract sterilization services to do them, depending on which service you use, you will get their method. The bigger problem is a lot of times we don't take the time or effort to understand the method. And so we just believe whoever's the contract sterilizer and do what they say and things like that without really understanding what's going on in your sterilization cycle. My big gripe is that most people don't understand the sterilization cycle that they use at the contract manufacturer. And the more experience you have, the more you may understand the difference between verification doses and sterilization doses and max dose and dose audits and all that. But more often than not, we don't take the time to learn that. And so we sit at the point of just having them tell you what to do, which may or may not be a good thing.
Can you describe the typical typical from start to end the cycle development to the validated process?
First, we have to make sure that you're getting dose into your containers, you know, that you're getting it sterilized. So there's a variety of studies that we do to look at where we place the dosimeters and how much dose you need to kill a log and how much you're going to use on a routine basis. How much is the maximum dose that you need to do? Usually the maximum dose is somewhere between 1.5 to 2 times greater than your sterilization dose, which is why you'll see max doses of 40 or 50 kilograys, even though 25 is considered an overkill cycle for them. And then you'll see a max dose of 40 and you're like, why does it need to do 40 if it's 25? But it's just how that works out. And you would run these early verification studies to make sure you don't have material study issues. Does it discolor? Does it break? Does it become more fragile? Things like that. And then eventually, you would also verify that you get sterility with that cycle that you've chosen. And you do your sterility testing with it. And then you would come back and actually run your 3 validation studies or more based on what your minimum loads and your maximum loads are and things like that. You could need more than 3 studies. And you'd put it up on stability and hopefully it stayed in good condition all through your stability life, and or you could have to come back and do something based on what happened in stability.
And that's it.
Yeah. The regulatory submission and getting them to bless it and that, but yeah.
Is there, in terms of time it takes, let's say everything goes normal, what do you typically plan for as far as validating a cycle?
One of the interesting things is that so many people who do contract radiation sterilization, there are so many people switching from ETO or that to radiation, and there's just not always a lot of space in those plants. And that's one of the big considerations in picking a sterilization vendor is how much time it's going to take to do that. I know certain of the companies that are out there today have dedicated plants that only do development. And so that it doesn't tie up production sterilizers to do it. So then you have to do it in one plant, and then you have to verify that it's the same when you transfer to another plant. I, believe it or not, I frequently tell them to leave 8 or 9 months open to get all of that done because of the time. They write their own protocols at those sites. They frown on you writing the protocol. getting them approved at the site, getting them approved at your site, getting scheduled into the schedule. And that's all great if everything runs right the first time. But if you start having problems, troubleshooting between their plant knowing what could be the problem, your plant knowing what you want to look at as the problem and things like that, just adds a lot more time than when you have the sterilizer at your own site and you control those things.
Very good. Thank you for coming on again, Gene.
No problem.
It was great talking to radiation.
Thank you.